Welcome to the Talking Tall Rounds series, brought to you by the Seidel and Arnold Miller Family Heart, Vascular, and Thoracic Institute at Cleveland Clinic.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to a segment of Talking Tall Rounds. I'm Eric Roselli.
And this is Amit Goyal.
Amit, it's great for us to get back together again. I really enjoyed our conversations over the months as we've done these podcasts to help highlight and provide another mechanism for people to share in some of the knowledge that we share here in Cleveland during our Tall Round sessions. And I look forward to this one. This is a discussion from a meeting that we had a few months ago on the topic of aortitis. In the usual Tall Rounds format, we sort of let off with a case, and this was a case of mine and one of our aortic surgery fellows, Heidi Reich, who's now out in California. She started her job in Fresno a few months back, and she kind of hit the ground running, gave me a couple of calls and asked me questions about a couple of complex aortic cases she was doing. So that was nice to hear. She presented us with a case that I thought was a pretty good representative one.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that Dr. Reich is doing well. I had the pleasure of meeting her in the OR for one of the TAVR cases. She's a wonderful person. So she talked about a case of a 73-year-old woman who was referred for a thoracic aortic aneurysm, which is dilating and had progressively enlarged from 4.9 centimeters to 5.6 centimeters within a year. Traditional risk factors, smoking, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, sleep apnea. And so, you know, she was brought to us for surgical management, given the rapid dilation. And she had a two-stage repair. Stage one, she had the ascending aortic replacement, a total arch repair with a frozen elephant trunk, and anastomosis with a two-stent B-safer technique. And then she came back in 3 months later for endovascular extension of her frozen elephant trunk. And Dr. Roselli, you know, I used to wonder as an early fellow, why not just fix it all in one go? What's the whole, do you mind just briefly talking about why we do a two-stage procedure?
Sure, that's a great question. It really comes down to limiting neurologic risk. When we do any kind of aortic surgery, any kind of thoracic aortic surgery, especially when it's involving the arch or the descending aorta, we put the brain and the spinal cord at risk. The brain circulation, we kind of figure that out pretty easily. It's the branches in the arch. And we've got really nice ways to sort of protect that by maintaining brain perfusion. But the spinal cord is a unique structure, certainly just as sensitive as any other central vascular structure like your brain to ischemia, but it doesn't have direct vasculature. So it's really the collateral network of all of the blood vessels in your torso that supply blood supply to your spinal cord via its connections with the anterior spinal artery. And so what we've learned over really decades now is that the greater the extent of reconstruction of that vasculature in your torso, your descending aorta, the more stress you put on the blood supply to the spinal cord. So if we can stage it out, and you know, in the elephant trunk operation, we might sacrifice a few of the upper intercostals, a couple bronchial arteries or something that are part of that network. The amazing thing is the body adapts within a matter of a couple hours, certainly within a couple of days, and other collateral vessels sort of pick up the slack. But if we replace the whole aorta from top to diaphragm through the whole chest, it's too much of a ischemic burden on the spinal cord. So we break it up into two phases. Because the second phase is endovascular, and like in this particular case, and with some of the newer techniques that we're using, it makes it a lot easier to sort of get somebody back to the OR.
That makes a lot of sense. So you're taking the patient to the OR immediately to stabilize a proximal aorta, and you're staging it to manage risk and use the body's own way of adapting and rerouting blood supply. It's a
exactly
good there.
It was a good example case, someone who had sort of planned at the time that we met her of getting her through that second stage. A lot of these patients, proximal aorta is really dilated, and we're suspicious about the distal aorta, and we end up kind of monitoring it for a while, and when we see changes, we come back. But this lady, we kind of knew right away she was going to need both stages. But it was, I thought, a pretty good example of somebody who met the criteria, and certainly her pathology did come back with giant cell aortitis. And the person who probably read that pathologic slide is Carmela Tan, who gave us the next discussion about the pathophysiology and classification of aortitis. And she did a really nice review and shared some really beautiful images from the histology and her vast understanding. You know, it's cool in this place where we've got so many people that subspecialize in things. Carmela Tan and Renee Rodriguez are not just pathologists that see all kinds of different pathology, but they're able to focus on cardiovascular pathology.
Yes, this was a great talk and really set the stage because unlike yourself and Dr. Tan, most people probably haven't seen or don't routinely think about aortitis. So she asked the question, what is aortitis? And it's an itis. It's an inflammation of the aortic wall, usually involving the media and the adventitia. She contrasted this from some degree of inflammation you can have with atherosclerosis. And you know, the classification of vasculitides in general is either is it infectious or is it non-infectious? Infectious aortitis can be from a whole host of organisms, typically bacterial being the most common. And non-infectious aortitides can be affecting the aorta, could be from large vessel vasculitis like Takayasu and giant cell arteritis being the pathology for our patient we discussed earlier, variable vessel vasculitis like Behçet's disease or Cogan syndrome, vasculitis with associated systemic disease like sarcoidosis, IgG4, and a whole host of other autoimmune and autoinflammatory conditions, and single organ vasculitis or isolated aortitis, which is actually a new one for me to consider, and we talk a lot about that. And yes, she showed great pathology to really give us an understanding of what's happening at the tissue level. She showed what the normal architecture looks like for the normal non-inflamed aorta and how it's disrupted from the different types of inflammatory vasculitides that can affect the aorta. And she said, look, the pathology establishes that there's inflammation, but you really have to be a doctor and a clinician because the classification ultimately is multi-parametric. We take our clinical, radiographic, serologic, and pathologic data together to develop the diagnosis and then personalize the management as you do.
That's absolutely right. I think that's a great point. I hear you with this discussion of the isolated aortitis, the single organ vasculitis. That one always kind of has thrown me off, even though I take care of a ton of these patients. And it's always interesting to me when we work across disciplines to get a appreciation for the perspective of someone from a different discipline. The rheumatologists are the ones that sort of who take care of so many of these vasculitides. Are the ones that sort of came up with this nomenclature about single organ vasculitis. They see the aorta as a separate organ. And as surgeons, we don't really think about the aorta as some sort of isolated thing. We think of it as just sort of the main trunk of the vascular tree. And so this single organ vasculitis or isolated aortitis most often does have giant cells in the specimens. It's just isolated to the aorta and not other parts of the vascular bed. So I think there's a lot of overlap there in sort of giant cell arteritis, which, you know, we typically learn about with superficial temporal arteritis kind of presentations and the isolated aortitis. There's got to be some similarities or some in the immune system that cause that overlap. But for whatever reason, we just see it's affecting the aorta in those people. And we've done some studies where we've tried to understand why. You know, looking at things like the microbiome of the aortic wall in aortitis, and found a few interesting things.
It's fascinating.
Just scratching the surface there, I think. Like with most immunologic sort of mediated sort of disorders, I think we're just starting to learn a lot.
Well, I think that makes it very exciting, right? Because you just know that there's so much to learn. You know, the field is ripe to, you know, develop a better understanding.
Absolutely. I mean, mentioned the microbiome part. That was a study where we brought in the genetics team that does all this really cool stuff working with cancers to look at the aortitis patients.
That's really cool.
Yeah. I mean, that's like the whole idea that you and I talk about all the time. That's the cool thing about Tolerance is bringing people that sort of you know, are working in different areas together to share sort of ideas. And I think we can do the same sort of thing with research as well.
Definitely.
But when the patients present with advanced stage disease, we got to treat them. And that's kind of the business that we're in here. The better we kind of understand things, the better we can plan what we do. So, you know, Dr. Tan and the pathologist have taught me to sort of look at these diseases in a different way. And I'll talk about that in my segment where, you know, I might be more aggressive or prophylactic sort of in how we repair some of these things now that I've learned what's happening at a microscopic level. But when they come to us with disease, it's often with images. And Paul Schoenhagen, just, you know, is a master of cardiovascular imaging, gave us a really nice review of how he looks at aortas.
Yeah, truly a master. You know, from the CCU perspective, we rely on his skills and insights so heavily. And folks, there's just no substitute for, you know, going onto the website and watching the video and earning CME credit, because the images he shares, CT, MRI, PET-CT, of what infectious aortitis, mycotic aneurysms, inflammatory aortic aneurysms that are non-infectious look like. You know, on CT, we're looking for wall thickening, branch vessel stenosis, which may be a key characterizing feature of Takayasu, as well as calcification. And on CMR, we're looking for wall thickening and branch vessel stenosis. You pointed out how we used to look for wall inflammation on CMR, but the data there hasn't panned out and the test characteristics are poor. But we have a substitute of a PET-CT to look for the inflammation. So he really, again, he goes over some representative cases, and I really do encourage you all to take a look at the video.
I agree. It's interesting. You know, I think a lot of people think about vasculitides as being these really uncommon things and look for this inflammation, the wall thickening and the stenosis, which are certainly are less common. The more common thing that we see, and we hear from this a little later from Carol Langford from rheumatology, is that isolated aortitis, which really just presents with aneurysm. And I think what happens is they've had their inflammatory disease occur sort of silently. Who knows? Maybe they had vague sort of pain, or you know, a lot of these rheumatologic disorders cause these sort of vague overall kind of body symptoms, and then it burns out. But the damage that's been done to the aorta has made it vulnerable to then go on to progress to aneurysm years later. Paul showed us a whole bunch of these sort of really neat and kind of unusual images of some of the inflammatory aneurysms and things like Takayasu with obstructed vessels. But again, mostly what gets passed through and delivered to sort of really needing some intervention are people with things that just look like aneurysms, but there's unique patterns to that. And we'll talk about that a little later. Sagar Kalahasthi is a cardiologist who specializes in taking care of patients with aortic disease, as the director of our connective tissue disorders clinic, but certainly sees a lot of patients with aortitis as well. And I thought he gave us a really great discussion about how these patients present and the diagnostic criteria. And we're going to include his talk verbatim here, aren't we?
Yes, you know, Dr. Kalahasthi is one of my favorite people to learn from, and so I'm excited to share with the audience towards the end of this podcast. But as you're waiting for that, I want you to think about five questions that he'll answer for you for us. One is, what are the clinical manifestations of aortitis? Two, what is the diagnostic criteria for Takayasu arteritis? Three, what is the clinical vascular lesion that is classic for Takayasu arteritis? Four, what is the diagnostic criteria for giant cell arteritis? And five, what do the majority of patients with giant cell aortitis die of? And you know, he also went through two phenomenal cases. We won't include those in the audio because he shows a lot of images. But again, just take a look at the video so you can get learning from him and also see the cases that show like why Takayasu arteritis and giant cell aortitis are so important.
Yeah, I think this topic was one that is really well represented by the video. So join us for that as well, folks, and get your free CME. Then we hear from Carol Langford, who's a world expert in vasculitis in the rheumatology department of rheumatology, has a really great understanding and provides us with her perspective of spectrum of patients that we see and thoughts about how to manage these diseases from a medical standpoint.
Yeah, she
Starting
brought a
with the
lot.
discussion of giant cell arteritis, right?
Yeah, she brought in a lot of insights here. And so, with giant cell arteritis, it's the most common systemic vasculitis, and it has four main phenotypes to consider. One is polymyalgia rheumatica, it's that stiffness and aching of the shoulders and the hip girdle. Two is a cranial disease with the temporal headache and jaw claudication, which is a harbinger for possible vision loss and stroke down the road. Three is a systemic inflammation with constitutional symptoms. And four is a large vessel disease that it really is the topic of our discussion today, with branch vessel stenosis and thoracic aortic aneurysm. And 1 out of 5 patients are grizzly. I didn't realize it'd be 20%. 1 out of 5 is a lot to consider here. And she went over the treatment, and of course, we'll look toward our rheumatology colleagues here, but steroids remain key within the treatment paradigm for giant cell arteritis. They're effective, but they don't prevent as relapse, which is also news to me. And so there's a lot of excitement at looking at steroid-sparing agents and biologics like tocilizumab and abatacept. We went on to Takayasu arteritis, a giant cell vessel granulomatous inflammation affecting the aorta, the branch arteries, and pulmonary arteries. And its presentation is with systemic inflammation, those constitutional symptoms in our patients. So that review of systems is so key: fever, fatigue, weight loss, arthralgias, myalgias. Of course, the vascular manifestations like vascular tenderness, the carotidinia, aneurysms, and the classic lesion of stenotic vessels causing claudication and pulselessness. So again, going back to the physical exam. Treatment again, foundations are with steroids. And some data, although limited, for steroid-sparing agents. Finally, we went on to the focal isolated aortitis. It's a pathologically proven disease. This isn't just a radiographic finding. And it's typically found post-op on histopath after a patient comes in electively for an idiopathic aortic aneurysm. But the question here is, what do you do after somebody like Dr. Roselli excises and repairs the inflamed aorta? What's the recurrence? There's not a lot of data here, but we have a series out of the Cleveland Clinic. Dr. Roselli, I'm sure you can speak to this also, but it's an N of 65 patients with 6 months follow-up. And a significant proportion, 45%, had new vascular lesions. But it was unclear if medical therapy with anti-inflammatory agents would have reduced the new vascular lesions in follow-up. And so, her approach that she delineated for us was, to really monitor and follow up these patients after surgical treatment, with radiographic progression, are they having new symptoms? Potentially was there, and if there was persistent aortitis beyond the resection plane, then to obviously do a little bit more aggressive follow up. But Dr. Roselli, what's your approach for these patients? Because you see them after surgery.
Yeah, we always get the rheumatologists involved, and we have the advantage of having a group of rheumatologists who see a lot of these patients and kind of can differentiate them along the lines that Dr. Langford spelled out. And earlier, 20 years ago, when Gary Hoffman and Toby Cosgrove were first sort of looking at this question, they were pretty aggressive with treating with anti-inflammatories and, immune mediating drugs, mostly steroids and some methotrexate. I think for the most part, we're learning that most of these patients with the focal isolated aortitis, that doesn't make a difference. And I think it's because those are people that have this sort of burnt out disease. So one of the things though we've seen is that some of these patients kind of have a combination of that and also have some of these other systemic manifestations like polymyalgia rheumatica or some of the cranial disease. And so what's really nice about having the rheumatologist along is they're certainly, again, with our group, they're not super aggressive about treating the people medically because there are serious side effects to those medicines, especially in someone who you've just operated upon. But what they do is try to assess whether they think there's any active process going on. We'll get a SED rate, a CRP or something on these patients if we have any suspicion. So at least we have some sort of baseline measure to go upon. And I think you can use some of that lab work, even though it's not very specific, to help guide those decisions, as well as, very focused kind of clinical exam by a rheumatologist who sees lots of people with these other systemic manifestations of these things. But with regards to the aortic disease, it's kind of, again, I think one of these things where the damage has been done and we just have to monitor them. And we often see these patients who will come in with a large proximal aneurysm and this kind of mildly, moderately dilated thing distally progress pretty fast distally over a short period of time, like a single digit number of years. And I don't think the medicine makes a difference in the development of aneurysmal changes in the aorta, but certainly has an important role in managing active inflammation.
Yeah, it sounds like the keys are to use all the data available to us to personalize management and follow up, to minimize harm from anti-inflammatory therapies, and to work as a collaborative team, creating a you know, a whole team of skilled clinicians around the patient to help guide all of these decisions.
Perfectly well said. Couldn't said it better. And another element of that team, which we hear from next in this program, is Jared Rouse from Vascular Surgery, who really focuses on the interventional and surgical treatment of those really first level branches off the aorta that are often affected by this in people with giant cell arteritis and Takayasu.
So there were three key points. One was that in these patients, medical management is absolute first line, because this is a, you know, this is a systemic inflammation involved. The second point was to avoid intervention in active disease because there's a high rate of failure, both surgically and percutaneously. But there were four situations where maybe we can't wait. And those were if there's symptomatic carotid stenosis with impending risk for cerebral ischemia, renal involvement with severe uncontrolled hypertension, pulmonary edema, acute worsening renal failure, mesenteric ischemia with a risk for gut infarction, and extremity ischemia, which, you know, we do see on occasion. And the third point was, if you do have to do intervention in active disease, then we'd prefer the endovascular approaches. Angioplasty alone would have probably poor long-term outcomes, but, you know, we would try to save our stents, recovered stents, you know, during remission. And same for open surgery, to, you know, reserve those for, you know, once in the chronic phase when the active inflammation has faded. So maybe Dr. Roselli, do you mind just commenting on, as a surgeon, what's it like, you know, thinking about taking a patient when they're actively inflamed, what the tissue is like, what are the challenges that you face?
Yeah, I've taken care of a few of these patients. I usually do defer them to the vascular surgeons, but I learned a lot about this this problem in particular from Roy Greenberg, who's no longer with us, but it's just, you know, his pioneering work still touches us every day. And, you know, Roy really focused in on the intervention in these folks about how to do it best. Ballooning these vessels just doesn't work. They recoil, they're acutely inflamed. You get the combination of kind of maybe making the inflammation worse after you've ballooned it. They need to be stented most of the time. And interestingly, with that active inflammation, the bare stents also, they kind of build up with that inflammatory material and, you know, whatever that hyper endothelialization kind of process is that that happens in these people. But they had some pretty decent success with covered stents. And the nice thing is you can get covered stents into these medium-sized vessels. You know, you may need a little bit larger bore access to do so. That can often bridge the patient through the acute phase long enough. You can actually handle it with an open operation later when you've got vessels that you can feel confident sewing to and bypassing. The covered stent sometimes will buy you enough time and they'll stay patent enough in a big enough vessel that it might be definitive. But that was one of the lessons that you know, Roy taught us. He had a, you know, not a huge series, but a big enough series where, you know, they were desperate enough to try a whole bunch of different things and learn pretty quickly from. And it's kind of cool when you don't need complex statistics when you have enough patients to make some really keen observations on, and it can still have a big impact if you look closely enough at that subset of patients. And then I stepped to the microphone in this one. You know, I've always been interested in this topic, and I think it's because it's been surprising to me to see how many of the patients that we operate on for thoracic aneurysms carry this diagnosis. Lars Svensson taught me a long time ago that when you send an aorta specimen off in the operating room, don't just send it to pathology, ask specifically that they do a histologic analysis, because it's not necessarily routine. I've made some observations over time and, you know, been able to sort of predict that they might come back and then histology, find some giant cells and some specimens, and been pleasantly surprised that you can predict this based on certain characteristics. Shared some of that learning.
It's like Dr. Tan said, we learned so much from the histology after resection because so much of the diagnosis is made following resection. For the audience, we'll include Dr. Roselli's talk at the end of the audio, but I'm going to give you five questions to ponder as you wait for this. One is, what aortitis syndromes and manifestations bring the patients to the OR in the first place? Two, what's the rate of reintervention for these patients? And, you know, that goes back to how we follow them up. 3, what is the most common concurrent cardiac surgery these patients end up needing when they're going for aortic surgery? And that may have an impact on our preoperative evaluation. 4, what are the Roselli rules for suspecting isolated aortitis preoperatively? 5, what implications does suspicion of aortitis have on the surgical approach, you know, going back to trying to anticipate that there's inflammation and how that informs your management in the OR and setting us up for success down the road?
Thanks, Amit. I thought this was a cool one because we stayed on time as well, allowed for a period of some panel discussion for a few minutes at the end, which is also included in the video presentation online and CME. It's a topic that I think we're going to continue to learn a whole lot more about, and maybe even some of the things we've learned about how the immune system works from the pandemic in the last year or two are going to help us to think about looking at some of these other chronic diseases in different ways. And we'll learn more about the pathophysiology and potential treatments, medical treatments going forward.
Yeah, this one was a lot of fun. I learned a lot. It's not a topic that, you know, that we think about so often as cardiology fellows. So I'm really excited to share this with everyone.
Well, great talking with you once again, Amit. And for those of you listening, if you'd like to get complimentary CME and see the videos, which I think there's plenty of good pictures in this one and some good video to see to include, it's worthwhile if you're interested. And we look forward to chatting with you again for another Talking Tolerance going forward. Thanks, Amit.
Thanks, Dr. Roselli.
So as Dr. Tan has already mentioned, classification of aortitis falls under broad categories of inflammatory versus infectious aortitis. If you look at the inflammatory aortitis, there are large vessel vasculitis and other vascularities. For our focus today would be on talking about GCA and tachyarteritis. Just as Dr. Tan had mentioned, there are many other conditions that can lead to aortitis, including sarcoidosis, as well as isolated aortitis and chronic periaortitis. And of course, the infectious aortitis that is predominantly caused by bacterial infections, primarily reported in the literature, are Salmonella species, Staph species, Streptococcus pneumoniae, and syphilitic aneurysms are very rare at this time. Mycobacterial, again, is not very commonly seen in the US, but those are the infectious aortitis to be kept in mind. So in general, if you look at the clinical presentation of aortitis or vascularities, many different abnormalities are reported in the literature. Primarily, aneurysmal disease is what we see in the cardiovascular side with thoracic or abdominal aortic aneurysm. Other specific features that are seen in patients with aortitis is aortic insufficiency, either acute or chronic aortic insufficiency. Stable angina pectoris or presentation with an acute coronary syndrome caused by coronary involvement, primarily, I would say, with aortic inflammation. Aortic thrombosis and distal embolization, as well as aortic dissection, in general, tends to be rare complications. But more commonly, you may see patients with upper and or lower extremity claudication with pulse deficits or hypertension in a young patient, such as in tachyarteritis, as Dr. Tang mentioned about renal artery involvement in patients, particularly with abdominal aortic tachyarteritis involvement, can lead to hypertension in a young patient. So these are the ACR criteria for tachyarteritis. If you look at multiple of these criteria, so I'll highlight some of the major ones. Age of onset, typically less than 40 years, claudication of extremities, decreased brachial artery pulse or blood pressure difference between the arms, BRUI, or arteriogram abnormality. So more than three or equal to three criteria is consistent with the diagnosis of tachyarteritis with a sensitivity of 91% and a specificity of 98%. Keep in mind, there is no mention here about the cardiac manifestations of the disease, such as aneurysmal disease or coronary involvement or valve involvement. So if you look at the overall major takeaways in tachyarteritis, is primarily it's an arterial occlusive disease, much more commonly, that affects the aortic arch and the large vessels. Abdominal aortic involvement is reportedly more common in the literature, followed by descending thoracic aorta as well as the aortic arch. Stenotic lesions are much more commonly seen, and aneurysm formation is reported in about 45% of the cases. So 40% of patients do have cardiac manifestations with tachyarteritis, the most common ones being angina pectoris, acute MI, aortic valve regurgitation. This is primarily due to aortic valve or aortic inflammation that tends to lead to involvement of the aortic valve cusps and coronary arteries. Pulmonary artery involvement has also been reported, although large pulmonary aneurysms have not been described frequently. So there are many different types of tachyosis involvement based on angiography, and this has been presented or based on the International Tachyosis Arteritis Conference, talking about the different patterns, and the disease activity can predict what forms of tachyosis manifestations are commonly seen. In general, angiographically, type 4 was the most common, followed by the other types, going from 2, 1, 4, and 3. Tachyosis and giant cell arteritis are a common forms of aortitis. Aneurysmal disease is seen much more commonly with GCA, and occlusive disease is a little bit more commonly seen with tachyosis arteritis. Branch vessel occlusive disease is more common in tachyosis arteritis, and aortic valve regurgitation appears more common with valvular lesion in tachyosis compared to giant cell arteritis. And coronary artery disease primarily appears to be related to aortic inflammation involving the coronary ostia.
I'm going to talk about some surgical considerations in treating aortitis. This is an important population that we see. Disclosures are shown on this slide. We heard from Dr. Langford about this study, which is the most recent thing we published about our experience with operating on patients with aortitis, non-infectious aortitis, that is. And we've heard a lot from all the speakers about the different categories. And interestingly, what we see in the operating room, or the aortitis that brings us to the operating room, is typically patients with aneurysms. We saw with tachyosis, it's a smaller percentage of the patients, and we just heard from Dr. Rouse about the obstructive and occlusive disease. But the bulk of patients that we see that come to the operating room are patients with the clinically isolated aortitis. Of the overall experience of thoracic aortic surgery patients that we see, it represents around 2 to 3% of the patients. In this series, the average age was 66 years old, and 2/3 of them were female. And the extent of repair is demonstrated here. We almost always replace the ascending aorta and then operate on the arch to variable amounts. Increasingly, in the last several years, we've been extending that repair into or beyond the arch as we've recognized progression of disease in the more distal aorta. And so, although we've heard from our medical colleagues about how we categorize these patients with clinically isolated aortitis as just involving the aorta has multiple segments. And we have to think about what's going to happen to those segments down the road and plan our operations accordingly, because that more distal aorta often progresses. What I usually see, and the way I think about it, is this patient's probably had that inflammatory process going on for some time long before we met them. And when they come to us with an aneurysm, that aorta is already sort of burnt out. As Dr. Tan said, about 80% of the specimens they're seeing are these patients with this clinically isolated disease, and the damage has kind of been done. The good thing is we can do these operations pretty well. In this series that we presented, that we showed in that archive of rheumatology, the mortality was 3%, the stroke was less than 2% in a pretty high-risk population of patients. When we look closely at what happened to these patients over time, we have to appreciate that there's a competing risk of death. A lot of these patients are older, and this competing risk of them needing an additional intervention. Interestingly, in the ones that we had good follow-up in, 40% of those patients with a mean follow-up of single-digit number of years did go on to need another operation. So we have to think about that when we're taking them for that first operation, that there's, what are their risk of surviving to need another operation? And you can see that a lot of these people that went on to have those re-interventions were patients in that giant cell or isolated, clinically isolated aortitis group. I think there's a lot of overlap there in the disease processes. The clinically isolated aortitis patients do have giant cells in their specimens. For some reason, they just hang out in the aorta and not in some of those medium branch vessels that we see occlusive disease in. And even after that first reintervention, we even see some of these patients go on to need additional reinterventions because the disease often extends beyond that ascending aorta into the descending aorta and can start to encroach on the visceral segment of the aorta. For some reason, the infrarenal aorta seems to be spared. When we looked at this series, we saw a lot of patients required additional procedures, most often aortic valve surgery. We saw a nice example from Dr. Kalahasti, and here's one of our patients who had giant cell aortitis. You can see she's got a lot of AI, and that's the intraoperative specimen, and that's a typical finding. So when I'm operating on the proximal aorta and someone where I suspect aortitis, or we know about some history of polymyalgia rheumatica or giant cell arteritis, temporal arteritis, I look really closely at the aortic root. In this patient, we saw a lot of thickening involvement on the cusps of the valve, as you can see in this photo. You can see there's stents in the native coronary arteries because that inflammatory process encroached right on the ostia of those vessels. The downstream vessels were okay, just like what Dr. Kalahasti described to us. But I think the way we need to think about these patients is the way we think about all of our patients, is we need to balance the risks and benefits of those operations around the disease details, what those patients' other comorbidities are. Are these patients going to survive into that phase where they might need another reintervention, and our own personal surgical experiences so that we can provide lifelong care to these patients. My own personal rules for when to expect isolated aortitis are these here. We heard from Dr. Schoenhagen about the findings you can see on CT scan imaging in patients who have giant cell arteritis or aortitis, tachyosis, where you see the combination of thickening and aneurysm involvement. But a lot of these patients with the clinically isolated aortitis, like the example that Dr. Reich presented to start off, actually just present with aneurysm. Most of the time, they're older women. I notice often that these patients have a minimal amount of atherosclerosis. A lot of times the arch is spared or it's more normal caliber. And then you see some abnormalities in the descending aorta with some dilatation. Dr. Schoenhagen showed us the image from that paper from Mayo. And that's what we usually see. And then when we get to the operating room, if we have that suspicion, and you remember, Karen, when we were enrolling patients in the aortitis study, I was sending you guys emails up front saying, I bet this patient has aortitis. I was right almost all the time. And what we found when we got in there was this kind of look, where we see this patchy intima, what Dr. Tan and Dr. Rodriguez had taught me, they call cobblestoning sort of appearance of the intima. When we see that, if we've maybe planned just an isolated proximal repair, once we start to see this and think this may be aortitis, we're more likely to go a little bit further downstream, because we don't want this patient to show up, the 78-year-old patient to show up 5 years later when they're 82 with a big dilated descending aorta that we don't know how to handle. So when we anticipate that next operation, we think, okay, let's not burn any bridges, but let's prepare for a less invasive endovascular sort of next procedure. That is, we create a landing zone, and usually we'll tackle these one in two ways. If that descending aorta is not very dilated at all, but just sort of funny looking and I'm worried about it, I might do this zone two arch reconstruction where we sew an anastomosis in the arch, we create a bypass for the innominate left common carotid arteries, and that provides us a place where if things change downstream, we can easily treat it endovascularly. Dr. Rouse will reconstruct the left subclavian artery and put a T-VAR in that and be happy that he's got a nice piece of graft material in the arch to land that device in. Or if the patient's really got some more serious dilatation of the descending aorta and we think we're going to need to do something sooner than later, like the patient that Dr. Reich presented to us, we'll do a frozen elephant trunk. And now with this branched stented anastomosis frozen elephant trunk repair technique that we use, this hybrid technique that we can do pretty quickly, we have a low threshold to apply that in these patients. And we've written about that, these prophylactic elephant trunk procedures that we performed a few years ago. Those were mostly conventional elephant trunks. Now we're doing them as this Be Safer procedure. And in that paper, where we had 117 of these patients who had dilated ascending aortas, but a descending aorta that was less than 5 centimeters, but had an elephant trunk, the mortality was only 0.8%. And about 17% of that population, like 20 of those patients, had aortitis. That was a reason for this prophylactic elephant trunk operation. And you could see that a lot of them went on to have that second stage, even though their descending aorta was less than 5 centimeters at the time of that first stage operation. They all went on to progress
pretty quickly within a few years' time. Here's an image of this operation. Now, this is a patient with acute type A dissection, but the operation is the same. We put this stent graft device into the arch. We deploy that under direct vision. This patient's under circulatory arrest. We suture that graft in place. I'll make a little incision in the graft so that we can put a stent into the left subclavian artery to try and keep this arch reconstruction simple, but still secure this device in position. You can see there the branch is going into the left subclavian artery over a wire. We put that covered stent into that left subclavian artery and deploy it. And then we'll dilate it up to make sure we're happy the two things are mated together. And then we'll go ahead and continue with that suture line of the stent graft. So the stent graft sutured in place, and it's sutured in right underneath the left common carotid and brachiocephalic vessels. And then we proceed with our proximal reconstruction with a regular surgical graft sewn to that stent graft in the aortic wall and then around those head vessels. And this B-Safer operation is something that we can do pretty consistently with a relatively short circulatory arrest time. I think in the case that Dr. Reich presented, it was 32 minutes.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. Like what you heard? Visit Tall Rounds online at clevelandclinic.org/tallrounds and subscribe for free access to more education on the go.